all doing? I am Andrew, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Andrew.
And this is my first time speaking. So I'm honored. You know, I knew this time was coming. This is the first time I've actually been able to accept this. So I know these first few minutes probably gonna be a little nervous until I get rambling. But you know, I'm gonna tell some of my story, and I'm definitely gonna tell what it's like now and what I did to get to where I'm at now. I'm an alcoholic that's powerless over drugs, and that is part of my story. And out of respect for AA, I'm gonna try to keep that as minimum as I can. Let's see where to start. Okay, so this is probably my second time coming back to AA. When I used to come here, I just wasn't able to hear the message, and I have a completely new perspective on recovery. I grew up with a father that was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. You know, I carried that gene around, the genetic predisposition, or whatever they call it. And you know, like, I remember just being a young kid that I loved to feel good. And to me, like, riding a dirt bike, going fast, doing things like that, I got this adrenaline rush, and I wanted more of that, you know? And the first time I picked up alcohol, I was probably 13. I was at a friend's house that lived in, I grew up in Isle of Wight, Carrollton. You know, we moved over from downtown Newport News, like 70th Street or something like that, in 2000. And we moved out to the suburbs, and I thought this is pretty country. But the first time I drank, I had obviously made friends in the neighborhood, and I don't know how many liquors we had picked, but my friend's dad had a huge liquor cabinet, and we grabbed all the ones that looked like they had a good label, you know, or it looked interesting. Some had gold flakes in it, you know. But yeah, so we grabbed all these bottles, and my best friend at the time was staying at my house that weekend, and we went to my other friend's house in our neighborhood. And it's actually past our neighborhood. It's probably about a mile away. So we grabbed some shot glasses and a bunch of these liquors and just started pouring. And I can't remember exactly. I had probably 7 or 8 shots, you know, being 12, 13 years old. My best friend, he was probably like 90 pounds soaking wet. And, you know, he has that Napoleon syndrome, and he had just as many. And within like a few minutes, you know, spinning. And like, I remember feeling like, you know, this is incredible. It wasn't later on, but at the time, that was the first time I had some chemical change the way I felt. And, you know, after a while, the sickness started to kick in. We're heading back to my house, and my buddy, he's fallen into the ditch. And I knew we were about to get in a lot of trouble. You know, he probably should have gone to the hospital, suffering from alcohol poisoning. Couldn't stop puking. We got caught. His parents had to come over, and we had that long discussion. That was just one of many discussions to come, with other friends' parents and police and whatnot. But after that, you know, it'd been a couple years, and then sometime in high school, we started partying. Probably junior year, feel like that. You know, maybe my sophomore year, I hung around with some older friends, and that was just a thing to do, you know. feel like there's not a whole lot to do out there, but really there is. But when you're in high school, partying is, that's the thing to do. So, anyways, I started to party and, you know, sneaking out of my mom's house, well, my parents' house, my mom and dad lived together. You know, I do want to say, now I am going to be all over the place, just so I'm sure that's apparent, but my dad, being an alcoholic growing up with him, I remember I did not want to be like him. You know, there were many times that it was just embarrassing, going to, I don't know, a restaurant or a friend's house and just seeing him get wasted and having to, you know, have a friend follow us home or, you know, help carry him into the car because he was just gone. So I remember, you know, like I loved my dad, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. And, you know, he was a construction superintendent for a government contractor. You know, he was the breadwinner in the house. But there were many times where he just drank way too much and, you know, we just kind of brushed it off as that's just who he is, you know? And a lot of times he would say things that I would remember, you know, that when he would say them, it would hurt. And in the morning, he wouldn't remember. But I did. And I started to, like, have this resentment towards him. But, you know, I don't think it was, I don't know, it's just one of those things is, you know, that's just who he is. Had no clue, like, you know, this isn't normal. But there was a time when he had a job in North Carolina, and he was probably gone for a year or two. And this was right around the time I'm in high school. You know, like I played sports when I was in middle school. I didn't play for the school. I played rec leagues, played baseball. All of the kids in the neighborhood played some type of, you know, football players, baseball, soccer players. We all skateboarded and, you know, hung out. So there was always someone's house to go to. But for the most part, like after school, instead of going to, you know, do a sport or something, I wanted to go hang out with my friends, because that was, to me, that was just, you know, I feel like that's most kids nowadays, too. Maybe not, but anyways, so after school, it was pretty much, you know, we did whatever we wanted. My mom and dad, well, my dad, he was gone during the week. He would come home on the weekends. My mom, she would work, wouldn't get home till 7 or 8. And, you know, at this point, I wasn't really, like, you know, worried about being home for dinner. You know, she might have cooked something that we could just heat up. But I started hanging out with an older crowd, and a lot of them had cars and licenses, and a lot of them were partying, you know. So when the weekend came around, usually I would try to find someone's house to stay at. That way I knew if we were to party, I could get away with it without having to come home and worry about my mom smelling my fingers to see if I smoked or, you know, just being sloppy looking. And I think what happened when I started partying is right away, like I remember it being like my number one priority, you know. I was the guy that wanted to do it. I wanted to do it during the week, like I wanted to do it every night. And you know, we were drinking alcohol at first and eventually started smoking stuff. And I think when I had that combination, I was like, this is incredible. Why isn't everybody doing this? You know, it really became something I was doing every day. And, you know, there were times when I could smoke before school and be trashed through for first and second block, and at lunchtime I could run off to the auto shop at high school and smoke some more, and then just wait to party, drink on the weekend. And, you know, that became, I started to skip school after that. But it quickly progressed, and I don't remember thinking it was a problem, you know. I feel like it was just a phase, or maybe, I don't know. My friends that I partied with, they weren't doing that, you know. I would show up to school and be like, hey man, let me get your keys. And I would take their car and leave for the day so I could go party with my girlfriend or whatever. And I'd come back when the school day was over and pick my friends up. And there was one time I left my friend stranded, you know, at school. I drove my older beat down car to school and swapped cars, and I left him the keys so he could drive my car home. And it was like a 1986 Oldsmobile Pontiac 6000, actually, you know, the first car I ever had. And you know, I had no clue like what was happening to me. I had no ambition to go to school. I always had this idea that I was going to go in the military. But I was in love, or I thought I was in love at the time. You know, I had a high school sweetheart. And I'd had many relationships up to this point. I never really had a problem getting in a relationship. But I quickly wanted to, you know, I was only hanging out with people that were partying. So if you weren't partying, I wasn't hanging out with you anymore. So I had to cut off some friends, or not even cut them off. I went a different way. And, you know, senior year, I think I'd skipped. I went for an advanced diploma, so I had all the credits I needed to graduate senior year. I just needed an English. So I took that first semester, and I was able to skip my entire second semester of my senior year. And really, when I did that, I was going to fail a certain number of classes, and I wasn't going to get an advanced diploma. But I knew I would still walk with a standard diploma, and I was okay with that. And part of the reason I signed up to be in the advanced diploma classes is because there were better looking girls in those classes. And I found out that I was less distracted when I was around a different crowd. So, like, I don't know. I don't know if that was my way of manipulating at the time, but it did help me. And then when my senior year came around, I was like, oh, I can skip and continue to party. And I'm lucky that I graduated. And most of my friends at this point, you know, I took the SATs. I didn't have any colleges picked out. But I didn't know what I was doing. I just wanted to party when I got out of high school. That's all I wanted to do, was drink and smoke. And I did that for probably 2 years before my parents were like, you know what, Andrew, this is getting a little ridiculous. I wasn't working, you know. I would cut grass for money. My dad was alcoholic, so it was easy for me to, you know, take from his stash. At this point, like, I really didn't need a whole lot of money because, you know, I could give someone a ride. And I started dabbling with like the street stuff, and I started dealing, and like that quickly became this is what I was going to do. So that high school sweetheart, we've been talking for 4 years at this point, and she's actually in her senior year, and I've been out of school for a few years, 2 years. And it was like, okay, you know, maybe I should go to college, because I didn't want to leave her. And I really wanted to go to the Air Force or the military, but I wasn't ready to stop. And I knew that there was no way I was going to be able to enlist and stop partying and leave her behind. So I signed up for a technical college, went to ECPI, and I actually, at this point, I had started dabbling with prescription pills. You know, I ended up liking what I was taking. All the kids were, you know, we were drinking, smoking, and taking pills. And I found out it was real easy to get a diagnosis from a doctor for ADHD. And I quickly became hooked on the medicine they give you. And it was a party drug, because you could stay up later, you know, drink more, smoke more, and hold it together, you know what I mean? So now that I have this magic concoction that has made me, I don't know, I guess gave me ambition to do something, I started going to college, and I actually did really well. My mom says that I guess the admissions guy that does the test said I had some of the highest scores he had seen. I don't remember that. I know I was out of my mind when I took the test. But, you know, I went for electrical engineering, and probably for a year maintained. You know, I was going to school 5 days a week. And when I wasn't in school, I was hanging out with my girlfriend and hanging out with other friends that were partying. And it's actually crazy that I made it that long in school before I flunked out. So what happened was my girlfriend cheated on me with one of our guys that we got stuff from. One of our dealers, and I lost my mind, and the medication I was on was driving me crazy. Smoking and drinking wasn't helping me feel better. And at the time, like, I wanted to, you know, I wasn't ready to let her go, but I wanted revenge. So, you know, I started seeking, other girls I went to school with that I could hook up with. And I started skipping some classes at school. I had a couple one-night stands, and made some poor decisions. You know, I got on Facebook real late at night when I was trashed, and hooked up with some people. And I ended up knocking up this one girl that was in my English class. And it was it wasn't too much longer, she'd reached out to me and said she was pregnant, and I was in denial, I didn't believe her. You know, she told me she had a tilted uterus and all this stuff, but I really, I started to lose it, you know. The combination of stuff that I was on, all these substances, just really wasn't working. It was actually, I had to take more of it to feel, you know, it was quickly progressing, and it wasn't fun anymore at this point. Especially after getting cheated on, I'd never experienced so much anger. You know, I probably had to replace all the doors in my mom's house because I'd punched holes in them. Actually, I'm pretty sure I broke my wrist at one point because I couldn't close it for a month or two. And when this girl reached out to me and said that I, you know, might have been carrying her child, it really sent me off the deep end, and I stopped going to school altogether. Really what happened was I went to class and I was so jacked up I couldn't get up and do a presentation, and I failed that class. And there was another class where I was actually the only guy in a class full of nurses. But I was so messed up that I couldn't go into that class and sit, or like any other time I would have been fine. It would have been great, but I couldn't handle myself. Like I was nervous, I was anxious, I was just gone. And so I stopped going to school, and I ended up flunking out and trying to fix things with my high school sweetheart. And she, I don't know, it's not going good. But one day we're hanging out at my mom's house, and this lady shows up with this little baby, 6-month-old baby, says, "This is yours." And that was the last time I'd seen my high school sweetheart. She left, never seen her again after that. And you know, I'm 21, I'm getting booted. And I'm really taking that, I think that was my turning point, because from there I went into a deep depression. You know, I was in denial that that child was mine. It's like, obviously you're going to have a DNA test before, you know, I really step, and I'm not ready to be a father. And I really isolated for the longest time. I ended up finding out the child was mine, and I didn't know what to do with myself, you know. I didn't even know this girl. I didn't know her at all, and now I have a kid. So I coped with alcohol, I smoked, and prescription pills. And I didn't do anything for a couple years. Besides, I had to make some money to support child. She put me on child support. I started doing construction work. And I thought, you know what, my life is over pretty much. So, sometime after that happened, I couldn't tell you how many years it was. It was a few years. I think that was, you know, the point where the book says we go past the point of no return. And that's when I really started to use whatever I could find to make me feel better. And it didn't matter what it was, you know. I really progressed from just alcohol to other things, outside issues. And it got to the point where, you know, Andrew, you need to get, my parents wanted to help me. I started hanging out with started dating some girls that I probably would not even look at, but because they had stuff I wanted or they knew the right people, they quickly became, you know, the people. I was surrounding myself with a worse crowd. All the high school friends were off to college. They had, you know, the ones I used to deal to were long gone. And it was like I was going through that time when you get out of school and it's like real lonely. You're like, damn, is this what it's like to be an adult? Plus, I've got this kid with this girl I don't even know. So I'm looking for anything to make me feel better, and I'm just barely getting by. So my mom, you know, I started to get in some trouble. I started stealing because I wasn't, my paychecks when I got them would be gone that weekend. You know, I ended up ripping off some lady and I sold her a PlayStation 4 empty box filled with school books. And got my first felony. Got obtaining money by false pretense. They put me on good behavior. Or they said they would drop it to a misdemeanor if I, you know, didn't get in trouble. But you know, where I was at, there was no way. Like they basically gave me a slap on the wrist, said, "We'll see you in a year, don't get in trouble." I had a PO, I never checked in. I had met a smoking hot girl that was probably the worst person I could ever meet, and got introduced to some more outside issues, the ones that make you sick when you don't have them. And that's when I really hit a rock bottom. Within 30 days, I sold my car, sold my motorcycle, my dirt bike, everything I had, and I started stealing from my family. My mom tried to, my parents wanted to send me to rehab, so I only agreed if they would give me enough money to get by until I got on the plane. And I missed that plane 2 times. So for another, you know, took me a week to get on this plane. And I went to that rehab in Michigan. And you know, like looking back, I really wish I would have gave it an honest try then, but I wasn't ready, and I only went to satisfy my parents. And I left that rehab 2 weeks in. I detoxed and I got my first taste of a meeting, and I left. And they dropped me off at a homeless shelter in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I overdrafted my account because my dad paid it off since I was going to get help. As soon as I got the treatment, he was like, got a bill in the mail, and he paid off my bank, and I overdrafted it. And bought myself and my friend that left with me bus tickets back, one to Tennessee and one to Virginia. And it was St. Patty's Day, and the rest of the money just got hammered. I ended up missing the bus because I fell asleep and at the bus station. And you know, I got a suitcase. I have no clue where I'm at. My parents are mad at me for leaving rehab, and I ended up getting back to Virginia. It was a 48-hour bus ride. And things, when I got back to Virginia, I was living with my girlfriend, the one that introduced me to outside issues. And my story pretty much is like that for the next 5 or 6 years, you know. I would continue to get in trouble and try to go to rehab, or I would get in trouble at court and they would send me to the Salvation Army. I actually stuck through for the rehabs. After that first one, I was the model person at a rehab, you know. I was the guy that would come here and chair a meeting if the person from H&I didn't show up, you know. All my counselors thought for sure I was going to stay sober. And the funny thing is, like, I honestly thought myself, you know, like I was done. I wasn't going anywhere in life, and I knew I was probably going to die at some point. And I just wasn't ready. I didn't know what my problem was, you know. And then I started, I'd been to 3 rehabs, and then I got locked up, and I was in Hampton City Jail for a couple months. And I got out, and then I started to frequent the jails. And at this point, you know, I've got two or three pages of charges, felonies, misdemeanors. And I've pretty much given up on having a decent job. So it's like I'm going to have a trade because there's no other way I'm going to make a living. But I can't hold down a job because my disease has progressed. And, you know, I'm drinking and I'm doing things that... I don't know. Outside issues. I really, like, it's hard for me to tell my story without including them. But, you know, I was the worst kind, you know. So, the last two times I went to treatment, I went to treatment six times total. Twice was sent by court, and the other times I went myself, or was my parents sent me. I went to Safe Harbor in Portsmouth, and I had been running, you know, I was running from a probation violation, my second one. I knew that I was going to jail, and I checked myself into rehab. And while I was there, I was like, okay, I'm going to move away from Isle of Wight. I'm going to go to Virginia Beach. And I moved in. I actually did well in Safe Harbor. I met some guys from the Virginia Beach area. I actually enjoyed the meetings. I moved into an Oxford house. I started, you know, I was going to five meetings a week. I got a sponsor. I quickly became the president of the house at the Oxford house I was at, which was good for a little while, but I'd met a girl in rehab, and she moved to an Oxford house on the same street as me. So even though I didn't have a car, I didn't need one because my ex-girlfriend would pick me up and take me to work, you know, and I could hang out with my new girlfriend right down the street. So even though I got a sponsor and was doing all this, going to all these meetings, I really wasn't prioritizing recovery. And my sponsor, I picked the guy in the meeting, you know, I went to a meeting and said, hey, I need help. I just got out of rehab. I want to stay sober. I need a sponsor. And next thing you know, all the old timers at the meeting started sharing. And a friend recommended, hey, you should talk to this guy. So I talked to him, and he only had two other sponsees at the time. I was like, perfect, you know. He was the loudest guy in the room. Right off the bat, he was like, we're not gonna work out the book. You know, he said, I don't work out of the book. I'm going to just tell you to do these things. And after a while, you'll find out you're working a program. And, you know, I was like, cool. You know, I don't like books anyways, to be honest. I remember calling that guy. I didn't even want to call him, you know, because every time I called him, I mean, he would tell me what I didn't want to hear. And I made it probably 4 or 5 months before I started slipping up and I was lying about it. And I was in a bad position because, damn, I've been talking way too long about that. I was in a bad position because I had to kick guys out of the house I was in because they had relapsed. And here I am drinking and cheating piss tests myself, you know. I had no integrity. And eventually it caught up with me and I got kicked out. And I'm doing the same old thing. And then I got in this drug court program, and... while I, you know, a lot of people get into drug court, it's an 18-month rehab pretty much. It's an 18-month outpatient program. You go to classes 5 days a week. As you progress through the program, they take days off. You know, it's an alternative to jail. And I was looking at facing 2 to 3 years for my violations and the charges I brought back, which were shoplifting. While I was in jail, before I went to drug court, I found a big book. It was a first edition, one of the little red soft paperback first edition. And I started to read it, and mainly because there were no other books in jail that I could read. Because at this point, you weren't allowed to mail books anymore because people were sending drugs in them. So the only books that were left in the jail were the ones that were had been passed around. So if you got a hold of a book, you were lucky. By the bathroom, they'd have a stack of books and checkers and whatever. And I found this AA book, and I was like, perfect, a book. And I remember going up to my bunk, and I started reading it. And when I hit the I started at the doctor's opinion. I didn't start at the title page. I started the doctor's opinion, and I remember reading that, and I was like, oh my gosh, where has this been, you know? And then I hit Bill's story, and I probably made it halfway through, there's a solution before I put it down. And at this point, I was getting released to go to drug court, and there were some things that happened that made me believe, you know what, I should probably go to church. I've been missing church. I've tried rehabs. I've tried meetings, which I thought meetings were the program, by the way. So I'm in drug court a couple months. I'm going to church. I'm back with my ex, and I'm not going to meetings. I'm just going to my classes mandated by court, and I'm doing fairly well. But life shows up, and that obsession came back. You know what? You could probably drink on the weekend and by Monday pass a piss test. And I did that for a while and got away with it. And then it got to the point where, you know what? I couldn't stop, and I was drinking and smoking, and it was like, you know what? I'm going to just have to cheat these piss tests because I don't want to get caught. The fear, I tried to stay sober out of fear and going to church, and it didn't work. So I went to jail for a week, and they tried to send me to a rehab, and I got kicked out because I had my girlfriend deliver some stuff at the rehab and throw it over the fence. I tried to get rid of her multiple times, just so y'all know, okay? She was very codependent and sick as well, and when I met her, she didn't do anything, but being with me long enough, she started to do stuff. So I get kicked out of rehab, drug court throws me in jail for a week while the judge thinks of what he's going to do with me, and, you know, at this point, I'm really not sure what's going to happen, but I'm willing to go to rehab if they're going to send me to another one. And when I seen the judge, he was like, we're going to give you one more chance. So they sent me, well, they actually let me out on house arrest. I had one of those ankle monitors, and I couldn't go back to the rehab that they usually send people to. I had to pay a little bit of money to go to a different place, and it was a music-based rehab, and it was, you know, it was in Annandale, Virginia, which is right outside of Fairfax. So while I'm on house arrest waiting to get shipped off to rehab, I'm getting messed up, and the judge had told me, if you test positive one more time, I'm gonna kick you out. And of course, they tested me before the morning before I left. You know, I had to show up to a class to ship off to rehab, and they tested me. But they let me slide because we had already put some money down for me to go to this place. And while I was there, you know, I was honestly thinking I'm not done, because I hadn't been running that long. And, you know, I was just going to satisfy this requirement for drug court, and I didn't want to go to jail. But when I got there, it was a small group, and we went to a lot of AA and NA, and I learned some things about the brain while I was there, you know, like some subconscious things. And I talked to a lot of the people that worked there, and I found out that most of them all worked a 12-step program, or they were all in AA. And I was like, okay, maybe I should really give this a try. And while I was in rehab, something happened where I realized that I'm going to die, or I'm going to end up in prison for the rest of my life if I continue on this path. So while I was in rehab, I decided I need to get a sponsor before I get back to Virginia. Cause when I get back to Virginia, I'm not going to be able to drive anywhere. I'm going to be back in drug court, and I'm not sure what meetings I'm going to be able to go to. So I was asking one of the counselors at rehab to sponsor me, and he couldn't because of HIPAA. But he knew some people. And he had a guy reach out to me. And at this point, I had already gone to a meeting, and I'd picked the guy with the 69 Camaro and the, you know, the brand new Camaro, and, you know, worked out all the time to be my temporary sponsor. And I was calling him every day. But I really wasn't getting the spiritual conversation from him that I was craving, and I was getting it from other people at the meetings I was going to and at the rehab, people that worked there. And I ended up meeting my sponsor. Well, I didn't meet him. He spoke at the rehab, and I was at the house that they rented for us to stay at, watching him on Zoom tell his story. And he was in it, he had a very similar story. You know, we were both in drug court. We both gave drugs to our friends that killed them. We had a lot of things happen that, you know, it was just wild. And somehow he ended up getting my number and reached out to me from that counselor I was trying to get sponsor me. And I started talking to him, and it was not a night while I was there that I didn't talk to him for less than an hour. It was very clear. He told me from the start, look, we're going to go through the book. We're going to read once a week. You know, if you meet every week, I can get you through the steps in about 90 days. And for a guy like me, there was a good chance that if I go back out to doing what I was doing, I'm going to die quickly. Because I wasn't just drinking at this point. And I never met Matt while I was still in Fairfax, but that last week and a half while I was there, I knew I was going to be okay when I got back to Virginia if I worked with him. And I came to believe that, you know, I've never worked a program. I've only gone to meetings, and I've had a service position, but I've never actually worked the steps out of this book. And I honestly believed, like, that everything people, all the solution that people were sharing in meetings would work for me. And it was weird, because I was actually able to hear the message in the meetings. Instead of, like, I used to like the war stories that people would share. But now, when I went to meetings, I heard the message, and I wanted to try it. So I got very lucky that I found a sponsor that was able to take me through the book in a manner where he read with me, and he was like, I only work with one guy at a time, so that way I can give you my full attention. And he was just finishing up with another guy. And even though I was moving 4 hours away back to Hampton Roads, and he was in Fairfax, we worked the steps through Zoom. And I video chatted with him, and we would read every week. I called him every night. He gave me the five things to do: go to a meeting, call him, pray, read some literature, and try to help somebody, and particularly someone you don't like. And I realized, you know, I really need to, I didn't take the suggestions with my first sponsor, so I made it a point to do everything I could with this guy. And when we started going through the book, I remember I had started listening to speaker tapes, and like I was also going to IOP drug court, and then I was doing Zoom meetings when I couldn't make it to Wednesday, my Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday meetings. So my whole day I was in some type of group or meeting, and I always looked forward to talking to Matt. And I remember when we got to the third step prayer in the book, like I'd heard it shared about, and I was like, oh shit, we're about to do third step prayer. And I was like, I was excited, you know. And I'm in my living room by myself, and this guy's 4 hours away, and he's like, go get a pillow or something. And I kneeled down and got my computer right there on the floor, and you know, we prayed. And I feel like that would have been great in person, but it was just as great on Zoom, just me and him and God. And I quickly got to work, you know. When I got to my fourth step, he gave me 2 weeks to do it. And, you know, I honestly, I've heard a lot of people's experiences of how they've gone through the book and how, you know, things are different. And like, I'm open to all, you know, if it works, it works, you know. The whole 2 weeks thing was great for me because, you know, I looked up to this guy at this point. You know, he was the guy with the solution, and I need to listen to him. And 2 weeks was great because if he wouldn't have gave me a time limit, I probably would have procrastinated. And I would have been like some other people that, you know, have similar time as me that still haven't done their fifth step. And I'm the kind of person that's not going to make it that long. I can't make it 2 or 3 months without going back out. So, you know, it only took me maybe 6 or 7 hours total to write my fourth step. And I did it, you know, not all at once, but I did the majority of it, and I did a very thorough fourth step within that 2 weeks. And I think it took about 7 hours to do my fifth step. I think my sponsor at one point said, hey, you know, you don't need to go into all this detail about, yeah, you know. So I remember, I don't know what was happening at this point. I think, you know, after I did my fifth step that night, I got the book. I sat quiet for an hour. I did the 6 and 7, and I already had my eighth step. And I did all that in one day. And it wasn't, you know, we continued to read every week. And I remember at some point, he had told me that I need to start making my amends and make one every day. And at this point, I don't have a car, so I'm not able to get around easily. So I made the immediate ones, my family first, you know, and I made the other ones I was able to. I still have some amends to make, but he also gave me 2 weeks to make as many as I could before we continued to move through the book. Because I don't know if anyone actually ever finishes their amends. I think some people do. But, you know, some of those, it's going to take a long time. And I remember after I'd made some amends, I was in a meeting one day reading the Nine Step Promises, and I realized that most of the things had came true for me. And I think it was a combination of, it was mainly I prioritized working this program above everything else. You know, when he told me, you know, to do these things, I did them. And I also had cut off that crazy girlfriend that, you know, because I was always in some type of codependent relationship. I knew a big part of me being able to do this was cutting that out, and I surrounded myself with AA, and it was very easy to do because I finally came to this point where I realized this is, hey, this is what you need to do, and I also got a job at Subway, which was probably the best thing for my ego, because it took me down a notch, and, you know, I always thought I was a pretty smart guy, and I could do a little bit of everything, and I was way too good to work at Subway, you know, but when I, like, even looking at my fourth step, like, all the things I've done, like, that was Andrew, and there were some dirty things about it, you know, but, you know, I really believe that I really didn't know what my problem was. I didn't know that this obsession would come back after a short amount of time. And to me, you know, I might not be drinking and I'm smoking and I might think I'm sober. I'm California sober, you know? And it was all a lie. You know, like being honest with myself, as I worked this program, there were certain medications I was on, maintenance medications for opiates, that as I started to work this program, I wanted to get off of them. And it's, you know, I don't know if, I think that was God and the program doing that for me, because I never thought I would be able to get through life without something. You know, I just hit 11 months on the 1st of June, and I've got a guy I'm working with now, you know? I made it through the steps before I hit 6 months, and a lot of people would probably think, you know what, that's a little quick, but, you know, that might not be your experience or others' experience, but it was just right for me. And when I read this book, a lot of times I see, you know, and next and next, and some of the speakers I listen to, they kind of seem like, you know, let's get it done. And it worked for me, because while I still had that focus, I got through the work. And now I get to grow in understanding and effectiveness and really refine, you know. Now I can go back and read the other literature. You know, we only worked out of one book when I went through the steps, you know, so I could focus just on this. And it's a miracle that I wake up and, coming from an alcoholic that is powerless over other drugs, that I can wake up today without anything in my system except maybe some caffeine or nicotine, and be happy and truly be at peace. And you know, I've got temporary custody of my son right now, and I got that, I remember CPS showing up in my house when I had my ankle monitor on about to go to rehab, and they were like, do you know what's going on with your kid? And I was like, no, I don't. Because I'd been absent for so many years. You know, I had no clue that today he would be living with me. And I have another chance at being a father, which I still, at 32, don't know how to be. But I'm trying, and I feel like I have an idea of what you know, what I need to do so he doesn't wind up like me. And, you know, it's just, it's crazy that things have gotten, it doesn't take long for me to build things back, you know. But at some point, like, I can build it and lose it. And I honestly, like, I know if I keep working this program, I don't have to worry about losing all these things. And I smell more blessings coming. But yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of things I wanted to say that I didn't, and I know I made it to the end, so thanks for letting me share.
Okay, our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers rent and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, and the General Services Office. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? Jake?
Got the pilot. Action obviously has meetings every Friday, and where is it? Where's the list of guys?
I don't know.
Oh.
You asking? I don't know.
All right, got Justin F. out of Sandbridge, Big Book. Is on the 10th, and then we have Brian B. On the 17th, April on the 24th, and Eureka on the 31st, all from Gracious Living. Thanks.
Thanks, Jake.
Yeah.
Anything else? Announcements? Okay, besides speaker meetings on Friday nights, we also have a big book study on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock. I've asked a friend to present the chips.